Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we have on the program a man who's been called a modern Renaissance man. Eric Greitens is a former Navy SEAL. He's a humanitarian and a Rhodes Scholar. He's author of New York Times best-selling book, The Heart and the Fist, The Education of a Humanitarian, The Making of a Navy SEAL. And he continues work with returning veterans in The Mission Continues, his foundation. Currently in Missouri, back to where he was raised, and doing studies there. Eric Greitens, a pleasure to welcome you to Access Utah.
Tom, it's really a pleasure to be on with you. Thank you for having me.
I'd like to start with Afghanistan. You, very interesting history. We'll get into it and how you became a Navy SEAL. Fascinated, you know. Most of us won't be Navy SEALs, so it's an interesting glimpse into Hell Week, for example, and what is it, 80% failure rate for people who attempt it.
Yes.
And it's very interesting things about who succeeds and who doesn't there, and your humanitarian work. But Afghanistan, you have an op-ed piece in the New York Times recently. This is on the year anniversary, of course, of the killing of Osama bin Laden by a Navy SEAL team. Must have brought things home, especially for you.
Yeah.
So what is your prescription for what we need to do in Afghanistan?
Well, Tom, I think that in Afghanistan, it's really important for us to have an extraordinarily clear objective. And for a long time in Afghanistan, some people have said we're there to fight al-Qaeda. Others have said we're there to fight the Taliban. Others have said that in order to do that, in order to be successful, you need to build an enduring democracy and a functioning economy and a solid security apparatus in the whole state. And we haven't had a really clear prescription for what constitutes success. And one of the things that I was writing about on the year anniversary of the death of Osama bin Laden was that it became very clear in Afghanistan that we've actually been fighting two different campaigns. One of them is that counterterrorism campaign against al-Qaeda. And the other one is this larger campaign of the idea that you want to try and fix Afghanistan, that you want to build a functioning government there, that you want to build an economy that's tied to the modern global economy, that you want to build a police and an army apparatus that's capable of creating security. And my argument was that when you consider that the Karzai regime in Afghanistan is ranked as the third most corrupt country in the world, and you see the, you know, very, very difficult time that we've had building these institutions in Afghanistan, that really it's important to remember that our fight after September 11th was a fight against al-Qaeda, and that by focusing on that, I think, is our best prescription for success.
But you don't think we should immediately leave Afghanistan?
No, I do not think we should immediately leave Afghanistan, and I think that there are ways that we can take lessons from what we're doing in Yemen, what we're doing in Somalia, that what we've learned is that there are ways to actually continue to put pressure on al-Qaeda and to put pressure on really genuine terrorist organizations, which actually still represent a threat to the United States, and that you can do that without having to try and fix the whole country.
Hmm. President Obama, in his speech, I believe, from Afghanistan on that anniversary, one of the points I believe he was making was we have been quite successful in disrupting al-Qaeda.
We have. We've done a very, very good job of disrupting al-Qaeda, and especially since that counterterrorism raid against Osama bin Laden a little over 1 year ago, we've put a lot of pressure on al-Qaeda's senior leadership. And al-Qaeda today, especially in that Afghanistan-Pakistan region, is weaker today than it has been at any point over the course of the last 10 years. At the same time, you have emerging al-Qaeda presence in Yemen, you have emerging presences in Somalia, and again, I think that you have to make sure that your focus is on al-Qaeda and where they represent a threat.
One argument that is put forward in support of nation building is that if you have these failed states, so that's going to breed terrorism.
Yeah, I think the real question is, when you engage in nation building, and sometimes it's appropriate to do that. Sometimes it's appropriate to try and actually build a solid functioning state in places. I spent a lot of time before I did work as a Navy SEAL doing humanitarian work overseas in places like Bosnia and Rwanda. I worked with kids who lost limbs to landmines in Cambodia. I worked with kids who were survivors of polio in places where you are working, and the key is the same whether you're doing humanitarian work or you're doing doing military work. The key is to understand what are the objectives of the local population and find a way to work with them. And if you're doing that in a development context, then you can be very successful at building schools, you can build clean water systems, and you can work with the local people. The question is, do we have that kind of partner to work with in Afghanistan? And when you consider that, you know, Hamid Karzai, again, a third most corrupt regime in the world, and what ends up happening is that we've been trying to work directly with the Karzai regime rather than, I think in some places, you'd be more successful working with local partners rather than trying to do everything through Kabul.
Now, what about Iraq? You've been in Iraq. Do you think we're winding down appropriately in Iraq?
Yeah, I think that in Iraq, we certainly, if you think of when I was last in Iraq, which was in 2007, incredibly different situation. Every time United States Marines left the compound, they'd get shot at by an RPG or a sniper fire would go off or an IED would go off. By the time the U.S. was able to pull out, we really had done a very good job in Iraq of building a much more solid police structure and a solid Iraqi army, which was able to provide some security. The economy had improved a lot, and Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which had, you know, had come in after the invasion, but Al-Qaeda in Iraq had really been eliminated as a major threat. Obviously, there are still major challenges in Iraq, but tremendous progress was made there over the course of from sort of late 2006 until late 2010.
Let's talk a bit about the book, The Heart and the Fist, The Education of a Humanitarian, The Making of a Navy SEAL. Eric Greitens, my guest, if you just joined us, former Navy SEAL, a humanitarian. His foundation right now, The Mission Continues, national nonprofit organization, challenges veterans to serve and lead in communities across America. And Eric Greitens now back in his native Missouri, studying and teaching there. He was a Rhodes Scholar as well. Tell me a bit about your grandfathers to whom you dedicate this book.
Yeah, Tom, I dedicated The Heart and the Fist to both of my grandfathers. My paternal grandfather had served in the United States Navy. He was a career officer in the United States Navy, August Greitens. He was a chief petty officer. And then my maternal grandfather, Harold Jacobs, was a corporal who was drafted into the Army in World War II. And this really book, I think, came for me, and a lot of my dedication to service came from that knowledge of what my grandfathers had done and what earlier generations of Americans had done and the way that they had served. My maternal grandfather, Harold Jacobs, also was one of the guys who got me first interested in boxing, and I talk a lot in The Heart and the Fist about some wonderful lessons that I learned about life from my very first boxing instructor, Earl Blair in Durham, North Carolina.
Hmm. Now, an example of service from your grandfathers, did you think growing up that you would be in the military?
You know, when I was a kid growing up, I thought about the military, but I also thought about the St. Louis Cardinals, and I thought about being an astronaut, and I thought about many different things. I'm not sure that I had any more interest in being in the military than I did in maybe being a baseball player or something like that. But as I did humanitarian work around the world, and as I saw what happened in Bosnia with the ethnic cleansing, when I saw what happened in Rwanda with the genocide, when I saw what happened when I was working in Albania and I saw refugees coming down from Kosovo, I just became more and more convinced that there are times when we need people with courage to stand up and to use their strength in order to provide protection to others. And so that was one of the things that led me into thinking more about joining the United States military.
And there's definitely a point where you have an epiphany on that line. We'll talk about that. I was interested, as a boy, you write, that you had two fears. Like, you probably had other fears, but these were two big ones. Maybe you were born in the wrong time. You'd read these adventures, and it seemed very safe there in Missouri, which is great, you know, growing up. And the other one was perhaps you'd miss out on a meaningful life, and you equated that. The ticket to that was college, so you worried about getting into college.
Yeah, absolutely. No, as a young kid, I had this idea that, you know, in order to have a meaningful life, that you had to get to college. And, you know, I actually write in the book about this story. I remember I came home with a bad grade in handwriting in the third grade, and I showed my report card to my mom, and she said, "Oh, that's okay." And I asked her. I said, "Well, will they still let me into college?" I have this bad grade on handwriting in the third grade. But for me, as a kid, I had this conception that that I really needed to go to college. What I ended up learning by the time I got to college was that, you know, we all have to find a way to choose our own adventure, and that it's not going to be chosen for you, and it's certainly not going to be chosen just because you've made it to college. There's a lot of wonderful things that I did learn there, and that one can learn there. But you have to find a way to really do meaningful service if you want to live a meaningful life.
We're talking with Eric Greitens on the program today, author of The Heart and the Fist: The Education of a Humanitarian, The Making of a Navy SEAL. So you do believe that service, humanitarian service of some kind, is the key component to a meaningful life?
I think it's one of the keys, Tom. You know, one of the things that I said at the commencement at Utah State University was that the best definition I've ever heard of a vocation is that it's the place where your great joy meets the world's great needs. And I think that in order to live a meaningful life, it's important to figure out how what you enjoy doing and how your source of joy can actually be matched to what the world needs. And there are lots of different ways to make that happen. But my message to the graduates was to go out and to find a way to match their passions and their creativity and their intelligence and their energy to meeting the world's needs.
Mm. So you ended up at Duke University, right?
And then, I did.
Then on to Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. An interest in humanitarian work, right? And that took you with your dissertation to many countries.
I did. So I wrote my dissertation on how international humanitarian organizations work with children in war zones. And over the course of my time as an undergrad and a graduate student, I had the opportunity to live and work in refugee camps in Bosnia. And I write in the book about what I learned from people who are on this really difficult front line in their life where they had lost every material possession they had ever owned. I write about, you know, what I learned working with unaccompanied children in Rwanda. These were kids who had been separated from their parents or whose parents had died during the genocide and had to find a way to survive and to thrive after that. And doing that, sorry, go ahead, Tom.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, and so doing that work, I really came to see very strongly that if we wanted to be successful in doing humanitarian work overseas, it was essential for us to understand the people who we are working with and to find a way to work with them to help them to execute their strategies so that they could survive and thrive in some incredibly difficult situations.
And I want to have you tell some stories from that time. I wonder if I could have you read a passage from the book. And I think you have the book with you.
I absolutely do. Absolutely do. And I'd be more than happy to.
Beginning on page 115. This is you at Oxford, your chapter in Oxford, but you're thinking about how best to help the world's people. You've had some experiences and you're thinking that perhaps the way a lot of humanitarian organizations go about it is the wrong way.
Yes. One of the things that I write in the book, Tom, is I say that amid the pleasures of Oxford life and the draw of the boxing team, I was still determined to find a pathway for humanitarian work. I wrote a dissertation on the subject, and my thesis was simple. What matters for the long-term health and vitality of people who have suffered is not what they are given, but what they do. Rather than simply giving aid to children, it made sense to support children, families, and communities that were already engaged in their own recovery.
Then you study the history of Save the Children. The founder became disillusioned with the way that things are usually done.
Yes, as a graduate student, I actually went back and I looked in the archives and I read all of this correspondence from a woman named Eglantine Jebb who had started Save the Children. And what I write in the book is that I learned how its founder, who had established the organization to help starving children after World War I, became critical of giving aid to children as a solution and began focusing on helping families find constructive work. I studied the starvation crisis in Biafra and the emerging literature coming out of Rwanda. I found the repeated appearance in the literature on humanitarian crisis from World War I to the present of sets of recommendations and suggestions that were all strikingly similar. Lessons, it seemed, had been written down repeatedly, but never learned or put into practice well enough to keep the same mistakes from happening again and again.
Then you go on to tell a very interesting story. I hadn't been familiar with this. Maybe some people are. Henri Dunant, I don't know if that's how you pronounce his name, and his experience. I wonder if you tell me about that.
Absolutely. So Henri Dunant was incredible, incredible story. He was the founder of the Red Cross. And this was a guy who in 1859, he was an unsuccessful businessman. He was on an errand of personal profit. And he woke one morning, he'd been following the emperor, and he woke one morning to find himself near a battlefield that was littered with the dead and wounded. Troops of the Franco-Sardinian and Austrian armies were lying desperate in the fields of Solferino in northern Italy. And Dunant later wrote, he said, the poor wounded men were ghostly pale and exhausted. Some, who had been the most badly hurt, had a stupefied look. Others had gaping wounds already beginning to show infection and were almost crazed with suffering. And what was amazing about that story, Tom, as I studied it more and more, was that what happened was Dunant stopped for only 2 days. He did what he could to help, but given the enormity of the suffering, his efforts were tragically inadequate. But later he wrote about his experiences, and that inspired the Red Cross movement.
Mm-hmm. He felt that the dying on the battlefield should have people with them.
Yes, he felt that soldiers shouldn't die and suffer alone. He thought that volunteers could help. And he thought that people who were wounded and those who were aiming to aid them should be exempt from attack. And that's where the idea of the Red Cross symbol was born, is that this was supposed to be a symbol on the battlefield of people who were actually providing aid, and the idea was to exempt them from attack. And it was from that same idea that even the tradition of writing letters and getting letters home to people from the battlefield was something that Dunant and the Red Cross started.
A businessman in 2 days, basically.
Yes, he was a businessman for 2 days, but he was really touched by this moment. And one of the things that I write about in the book is that I think all of us have a way that we should be and can be alive to the possibilities that life offers us. And we can be alive to these moments where we can be touched and we can make a decision about how we are going to make a difference in the lives of others.
I'd like to have you tell me a couple of stories in the book that jumped out at me. One is a dinner you attended. This was either in Croatia or Bosnia. I can't remember which one, which illustrated the divide in the country at that time of the war.
Yeah, so this was the context for this, Tom, was it was Bosnia, and it was 1994, and as many people will remember, there were some terrible bouts of ethnic cleansing at the time, and I was living and working in a Gashinci refugee camp, which was a refugee camp in Bosnia. The people who were arriving every day had lost every material possession they'd ever owned. They'd lost friends, and they'd lost family. And at one point, one of the aid workers invited me to actually come with her back to her home and to enjoy a meal with her family. And now you have to keep in mind, of course, this is 1994. I'm 20 years I'm 20 years old, and they sat me down in their home.
As many people were at that time, there's intermarriages.
Yes, there were some intermarriages, and so you had actually in this home, you had people who were Croatian, and you had others who were Serbian, and there were a lot of tensions kind of actually in the home because there was this intermarriage, and yet the war was really starting to break apart the actual was actually starting to break apart the homes, and I'd be happy to read a passage from that time.
Which
page would you like me to turn on there?
Let me see which page that was. I didn't actually have it marked.
I could just start with I'll start with a moment here. There were two sisters who were there who were from different parts of the family, and they sat at opposite ends of a long wooden table lined with children and friends and family. During dinner, I was asked about my work, my studies. Some of the conversation was in Serbo-Croatian, and though I couldn't understand the words, I could sense the strain between the two sisters. Short words, tight smiles, narrowed eyes. They passed around seasoned chicken, potatoes, vegetables. After we finished the main course, the hostess disappeared into the kitchen and then reemerged. "Eric, you must eat my dessert. Everything is of my produce. This cherry, this cake, this icing, all of my produce. Please, please, you must have some." Then her sister followed quickly out from the kitchen. "And this dessert is of my produce. Please, this is of my produce." The other sister said, "Choose what you like." Both sides of the family looked on. It was my first exercise in international negotiation. Should I side with the Croatian host's cake or partake of the Serbian pie? Should I be objective and pick the dessert I really wanted? How could I ease tensions and create peace? The sisters watched at either end of the table. I reached for one metal cake server, and then I grabbed another. With the server in each hand, I dug in and plopped a piece of each dessert on my plate at the same time. "These both look so good. I hate to take so much, but you have to excuse me. There's no way I could pass up one of these. I felt like King Solomon." Then my host said, "Please, you can eat them now. Tell us what one is your favorite."
They weren't going to let it go.
They were not going to let it go. Not at all. But it was a tremendous experience for me as a young man. Again, I was 20 years old. And there were a lot of lessons that I took from my experience in Bosnia. And one of them that was most profound was that the people who I saw in the camps who were often doing the best, Tom, they were the parents and the grandparents who had really young kids because they knew that they had to wake up every single day to be strong for someone else. And that was a lesson that stayed with me my whole life, is that when we think that we're in a moment of really great pain and great difficulty, if we recognize that other people are counting on us, it actually makes us stronger.
One scene in the book is very striking. You're on a train, I believe. You're heading out to Bosnia, Croatia.
Yes, yes.
And a woman asked a question that I'm sure resonated with you. She says, "Why isn't America doing anything?"
Yeah, she said, "Why isn't America doing anything to stop the ethnic cleansing, to stop the rapes, to stop the murders?" And she kind of yelled at me. She said, "Do you know what's happening to the people of Bosnia? You know what's happening. Now, why don't you do anything about it?" Of course, I had no answer for that. I tried to explain that I was there to help, that I was coming to volunteer. And she just said, "If you're going to help, why don't you do anything?" And that and a couple of other experiences in the refugee camps gave me a clear understanding that sometimes we draw these distinctions between humanitarian aid and military assistance, but that for the people who are actually experiencing war, oftentimes what they need is protection, and they need people who are actually willing to stand up and be of service in a way so that they can actually provide protection to families.
And is this what you're expressing in your title, The Heart and the Fist?
Yeah, that is the idea behind The Heart and the Fist, is that for all of us, you know, the idea is that we all have a front line in our life. We all have a place where we encounter pain and fear and suffering. And in order to win those fights on our own front lines, we all need a combination of courage and compassion. We all need a heart that's set in the direction of finding a way to be of service to others. And we all need the fist of discipline and perseverance and courage to make it through.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, second half with Eric Greitens, we'll talk about his decision to join the military, not only join the military, but to join one of the most demanding branches, become a Navy SEAL, and some very interesting experiences in that training. And we'll talk more about his work with the Mission Continues, which is a national nonprofit organization that challenges veterans to serve and lead in communities across America. A humanitarian, Navy SEAL, a documentary photographer, best-selling author of The Heart and the Fist, The Education of a Humanitarian and the Making of a Navy SEAL, Eric Greitens is my guest. More with him following this break. Fall fundraising at Utah Public Radio kicks off today with a web pledge day. You can support your public radio station with a pledge right now at upr.org, upr.org. The first 100 listeners who make a pledge today will receive a set of Plugs earbuds, thanks to iFrogs of Logan. Help us meet our daily goal of 100 pledges and $10,000. Make a pledge now at upr.org, and thank you. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest for the hour today is Eric Greitens, who is a humanitarian, a documentary photographer, Navy SEAL, former Rhodes Scholar, and author of best-selling book, The Heart and the Fist, The Education of a Humanitarian, The Making of a Navy SEAL. And we've been talking about his study of humanitarian work. It was the topic of his dissertation at Oxford. And we're going to be talking about how he decided to join the military and become a Navy SEAL. Just a couple more experiences, Eric Greitens, from the time at Oxford and your study with your dissertation. Very interesting trip to the Gaza Strip.
Yes.
And you had a sense that there's history on every street corner. There are long-standing, as we know, simmering resentments, and I don't know whether you came away less hopeful or more hopeful that that situation will ever be resolved.
You know, when I was in Gaza, this was in the winter of 1996 was when I went there, Tom. And so it was a brief period between a couple of the intifadas, and it was a time when it was safer. It certainly wasn't completely safe, but it was safer to find a way to go out and actually walk around the streets of Gaza. And I think when I left Gaza, I was not immediately hopeful about the immediate future. There were still some obviously really long simmering tensions there. And what I think I left with most of all was a sense for the respect one has to have for the history and the kind of humility that we need if we're going to try and understand a situation like that. You know, I just had a couple of days of dust on my boots walking around Gaza, and when I was there, I recognized that, you know, in 1996, Gaza had been controlled by Israel for nearly 30 years, by Egypt for 20 years before that, by the British for 30 years before that, by the Ottomans for 400 years before that, and over the course of the 3,000 previous years, by the Crusaders, the Caliphate, the Byzantines, the Romans, the Macedonians, Persians, Babylonians. So the point was, when I was walking around, I just started to recognize how little I really knew about the history and how much I would have to study in order to really get a sense for it. And you know, the streets were teeming with young men my age. A lot of them were unemployed, and a lot of them were in a very, very desperate circumstance. And so I thought back at the time about what Henri Dunant had written. And one of the things that Henri Dunant had said on the battlefield, he says, certainly I was a tourist, because he was only there for a couple of days. He said, I was a tourist much concerned with questions about humanity. And I certainly learned a lot on my trip to Gaza.
You made an observation in that passage, very interesting. You say that you observed that it's not the poor classes or breeding grounds for terrorists and insurgents. It's the middle class. They don't have to be scraping for their bread every day.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is actually, it's an interesting point. Eric Hoffer made this point also in when he writes about mass movements and discontented people. And one of the misconceptions that we have is that somehow that poor people kind of are revolutionaries. And the fact is, when people are really poor and they're really hungry, they rarely dedicate their lives to violence. They're more focused on the next meal. Revolutionaries are middle class or upper class or comfortable, but they're really frustrated and discontented people who end up choosing violence. Even, and this is true, across the board. If you look, of course, at Osama bin Laden and you look at the lives of the 9/11 hijackers, most of them came from middle-class Saudi families, and they were frustrated, they were discontented, and they chose violence. So I think it's important for us to understand that if we really want to think about how we also protect ourselves in a fight against terrorism.
If you think about poverty, just overwhelming poverty, some very interesting passages on your trip to India. You went to Varanasi. I'm not sure if you pronounce it that way.
Yes.
Mother Teresa's organization there.
Absolutely. So when I went to India, I went to Varanasi to work in one of Mother Teresa's homes for the destitute and dying. And they have a very simple mission there. And the mission is just to help the poorest of the poor to die with dignity. Many of the patients who I saw were seriously physically ill. Some of them were mentally ill, but they live in this small concrete compound, and there's very little there, but except that everyone is true to the mission of the sisters who are there, and that what they do is that they just live just as the poorest of the poor do. The sisters in that home, I think they own two saris and one pair of sandals. And I will tell you, having seen Navy SEALs, Army Rangers, Special Forces, some of the toughest people I've ever met in my life, Tom, were those missionaries of charity.
And there was laughing, there was joking.
Yes. And that was one of the things that was so powerful. It sounded from the outside like such onerous, such difficult work, but was so powerful for me to see was the way that these Sisters of Charity took joy in the work that they were doing because they felt that they were serving a larger purpose, and they were just incredible models of compassion.
You also write that they're very aggressive beggars in the area, and
yes.
The children that would come and beg, I imagine, just tug your heartstrings. But you were told, don't give them money because that'll just encourage parents to send the children out.
Yes. And one of the things that I struggled with, Tom, was that it's very difficult to say no to an often disabled, certainly starving, desperate, dirty kid. But I knew from what people had told me, I said, you cannot give them money because what happens is it's not good for the kids, and it actually just encourages the people who are supposed to be their caretakers to continue to send these kids out into the streets. And I found myself, after spending a day saying no to kids like that, that it could kind of harden your heart. So what I did was I would just, rather than having to refuse hungry kids, I just made it a habit to carry with me a small bag of food. And I'd have little rolls and grapes or cookies or bread, something in that bag. And then that way, when a kid came up and they tugged at my shirt and they wanted something, I had something to give them that I knew would actually be helpful to them and not to the people who were abusing them and were sending them into the streets.
Now, if you see that much poverty, that great number of problems, isn't there a danger that people who have good intentions perhaps just throw up their hands and say, well, it's just too much?
Absolutely. You know, one of the dangers is that people say, like, if there's this entire sea of suffering, and how can I make any difference in it? One of the things that I always try to remember, it's actually a phrase from the Talmud, and it says that if you save a life, you've saved the world. And I think it's important for all of us to remember any time we're doing any service is that you just try and make a difference in one life at a time. And if you can do that, if you can make a difference in one life, then you have to know that you have made a tremendous difference. And the entire, you might not be able to solve the entire world's problems, that's for sure, but you can make a difference in a life, and that has to be meaningful to us.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Eric Greitens. He's a humanitarian, award-winning author, documentary photographer, Navy SEAL. We're going to be getting to that part of the story. Very interesting. I wonder, Mr. Greitens, if I could get you to read another passage from the book.
Sure, Tom.
This is page 126. Beginning when I returned to Oxford and then continuing on the other page to the end of the chapter. This is, you're at Oxford,
yeah.
A Rhodes Scholar. You've been doing your dissertation on the subject we've been talking about, the humanitarian work. But at a certain point, I guess you start thinking, maybe I can make a bigger impact in the military. And just preceding this passage, you've been curious enough to talk with some Navy SEALs.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I talked with some Navy SEALs, and I was thinking about what my path was. And in the book, I write, Tom, that when I returned to Oxford, I attended a fancy dinner at Rhodes House, built in honor of Cecil Rhodes, who had established the Rhodes Scholarships. When we arrived, I pushed open a heavy black door with an iron door knocker cast in the shape of a lion. My date's heels echoed off the white marble floor. The main dining room of Rhodes House feels like the inside of a small cathedral. At one end of the room, a balcony holds pews, and at the opposite end, a wood-paneled wall holds a portrait of Cecil Rhodes. The house was sumptuous in a way that was unlike anything I'd ever seen before Oxford. Thick wooden beams, iron and white glass chandeliers, portraits of former Rhodes scholars, massive black marble fireplaces, woven tapestries on the walls, paintings of the rugged South African plains, marble floors, a grand piano. A long rectangular table was draped with a thick tablecloth and set with wine glasses, silverware, plates, and napkins folded to look like bishop's hats. Wooden cane chairs with woven seat bottoms creaked when we sat down. Here was everything that Oxford offered. Luxury, rest, time, freedom, wealth. Yet in the rotunda, I looked up and saw that the stone walls were etched with the names of Rhodes scholars who had died during two world wars. Seeing those names reminded me that the intention of the scholarship was to create public servants who would fight the world's fight. Many had left the comfort of Oxford for the trenches of Europe in World War I, or for combat across the globe in World War II. If they had chosen to stay at home rather than to serve, I knew that I wouldn't be standing in Rhodes House looking up at them. The philosopher John Stuart Mill once wrote, "War is an ugly thing, but not the ugliest of things. The decayed and degraded state of moral and patriotic feeling, which thinks that nothing is worth war, is much worse. The person who has nothing for which he is willing to fight, nothing which is more important than his own personal safety, is a miserable creature and has no chance of being free unless made and kept so by the exertions of better men than himself." I had no desire to see my name etched into any wall anywhere, but I felt a sense of obligation. My family was not wealthy. My parents had worked every day of their lives to support me as a kid. People before me had endowed scholarships that allowed me to pursue 8 years of higher education and never have to pay one penny. What was all of that investment for? Oxford could give me time. The consulting firm could give me money. The SEAL teams would give me little, but make me more. I thought, I might fail at BUDS, the basic SEAL training. I might find myself miserable, but I'd live with no regrets. I signed the papers as soon as they were set in front of me.
And so off to training. I wonder, of course, that investment of many people, what'd your parents think?
You know, at the time, my dad certainly was worried, but he was also proud and supportive, and he knew how important it was to me. And I have to tell you, at the time, my mom, Tom, was just really, really worried. Mm-hmm. She thought it was difficult. She thought it was going to be dangerous, and there were so many other safer ways that I could have served. She was really concerned about me getting hurt.
Yeah, I would imagine a natural reaction. So why Navy SEALs? You could have just joined joined one of the branches, conventional forces.
Sure. Yeah, you know, part of the attraction of the Navy SEALs for me, Tom, was the test. At Navy SEAL training, it's called BUDS, Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL Training. And it's considered to be the hardest military training in the world. In our class, we started with over 220 people, and by the time we graduated, we were down to 21. So it's this incredibly difficult training, and I knew that they would ask you to swim 50 meters underwater. They ask you to swim down 50 feet and tie a knot. They do these exercises called drown proofing, where they tie your feet together and tie your hands behind your back and make you jump in the pool. There were all of these great tests that were part of the training, and that was part of the attraction for me. I thought, if I'm going to join the military, I really wanted to push myself and to test myself, and the SEAL teams offered that test.
Tell me a bit about Hell Week. This is a very interesting chapter to read. It starts on Sunday night, and really, it's an apt description, Hell Week.
Yeah, Hell Week is a very apt description. In Hell Week, it's considered to be the hardest week of the hardest military training in the world. And over the course of Hell Week, the average class sleeps for a total of 2 to 5 hours. And during that week, they've got you doing 4-mile timed runs in soft sand. They have you doing 2-mile ocean swims. You're running the obstacle course. And it is a week of constant chaos and change and challenge and confusion, during which everyone, Tom, regardless of what their past accomplishments had been, their past athletic success, every single person is pushed past their mental, physical, and emotional limits.
So they've got you sleep deprivation. They've got you diving in freezing cold water, coming out, getting warm, going back again, long swims. It just really gets you to the core of who you are.
Absolutely. The idea is that they're going to push you so hard in the training that you have to confront and ask yourself the question, why am I really here? Why am I really here? And what they're looking for is they're looking for people who are there to serve a purpose that's larger than themselves. They're looking for people who, in their own moment of greatest pain, think to themselves, you know, there's somebody to my left, there's somebody to my right, and I need to find a way to be strong for them.
In fact, these instructors with, I don't know if that's the right word, instructors with bullhorns.
Yes.
I was struck that on one occasion they even... To push you, reminded you that that in the previous class there was a cadet who died.
Yes, there was. It was in the previous class, there was a cadet who died. And as we were running, and he had died in the pool. His name was John Scopp. He was a lieutenant who had died in one of the immediately previous classes. And as we were running over to the pool, the instructors were on their bullhorns, and they reminded people of that, and they said, do you really want to be here? Is this really what you want to do?
There's one special test, Steel Piers, I think it's called.
And yes.
Tell me what that is.
What happens at Steel Piers is that they run everybody over to these piers, which are steel, which are right on San Diego Bay. And what happens at Steel Piers is that the instructors come out and they get on their bullhorns and they start talking to all of the graduates, and then they make you jump into the freezing cold water. So the water at this point, Tom, is probably in the low to mid-50s. And while you're in the water and you're treading, they make you take off your combat top. They make you take off your boots. And you throw all of that onto the steel piers, and you're still freezing. And then, finally, they let you come out of the water, and you stand there for a while. You do a couple of push-ups. And then, as you're standing there, the instructors say, you know, being a SEAL is not about being a tough guy. It's not about looking Hollywood. It's nothing but cold and pain and misery. Do you really want to do this? And they let that sink into people's minds for a while. And then they say, if you do, jump back in the water.
Mm. And some people, just the anticipation of that, they know it's going to be incredibly hard. They quit then.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things that was so amazing to see was that over the course of all of this difficult work, what actually was amazing is that I said we went over from over 220 people down to 21. I could count on one hand, Tom, the number of people who I saw who quit when they were actually doing something. Hmm. What would happen is people would quit when they started to think about how hard it was going to be. And a lot of times the instructors would come out and they would start on their bullhorns and they'd start talking about what was going to come, what was going to come that night, what was going to come with the rest of the week. And that was when people would quit.
Interesting look at the people. I wonder, having gone through it, could you, with a fresh group, experiencing maybe a day with them, could you tell who's going to make it and who's not?
One of the things that was amazing was that you could not tell. I certainly could not tell. I mean, you looked at some people who came into the training and they'd been high school track stars or Division I college football players, and they had, you know, been international quality water polo players who came in Golden Gloves boxers, state champion wrestlers, but you just couldn't tell. There were other guys who they had trouble doing the four-mile timed runs in soft sand. They had trouble doing the pull-ups. But when they were in the moment of their own greatest pain, what happened was a lot of times the people who looked the best started to think about themselves. And they started to think about themselves, and it was then that they got weaker. The people who were in the training, though, who started to think at that hardest moment, you know, I have to do this for the people who are around me, they actually became stronger.
Mm. You also talk in the book about men who did drop out.
Yes.
They have to come to terms with that.
Absolutely. You know, and one of the things that's amazing is you can meet some people who this is, you know, 30 years after they went through the training, and you talk with them and they still want to pretend like they didn't quit. They'll say things like, well, my girlfriend at the time, she was going to college, so I needed to leave to go with her. Or the instructors didn't like me, and so they told me that I had to go to medical. And there are all of these kinds of excuses that are still there. And then there's another group of people who went through the training, and you meet them, and they say, you know what, I went to the training, I had a great time, I learned a lot. It just wasn't the right thing for me then. And they are able to come to terms with it and then find a way to take lessons from that training and find a way to continue to serve.
We just have a couple minutes left, and I wonder if you would tell me about The Mission Continues.
I would be pleased to. So The Mission Continues, I started when I came back from my last deployment in Iraq. And one of the things I write about in the book is that my team was hit by a suicide truck bomb. I was very fortunate, Tom, but some of the guys who I was serving with were hurt worse than I was. And when I came home and I visited with my friends and I visited with other wounded Marines at Bethesda Naval Hospital, I recognized that they all wanted to find a way to continue to serve, even if they couldn't serve in the military. So I took my combat pay, a couple of friends put in the money from their disability checks, and we used that to start The Mission Continues. And what we do with The Mission Continues is that we challenge returning veterans to find ways to continue to serve and to lead in communities across America. And so today we have over 350 fellows who work for Habitat for Humanity, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. They become youth hockey coaches, youth martial arts instructors. And in all of our communities, they are using their experience to come back and to continue their mission of public service.
And a good website is ericgreitens.com. More information on the book and on The Mission Continues. The book is The Heart and the Fist, The Education of a Humanitarian, The Making of a Navy SEAL. There's some heart-pounding scenes here from his military service that we didn't get into. The Heart and the Fist. Eric Greitens, a humanitarian and award-winning author and, of course, founder of The Mission Continues. He's been my guest. Thank you so much.
Tom, a real pleasure being on with you. Thank you.
Thank you. And join us again tomorrow for Access Utah. Thanks for listening today.
If I were very, very rich, I would hire a team of scientists and experts to prove that I'm not crazy.
Deseret News columnist Steve Eaton.
I wouldn't hire them to probe my head for mental illness, but I would be asking them just to observe me while I typed passwords and filled out forms online. There would be computer nerds, behavior shrinks, videographers, and pizza delivery guys all there to create and witness these experiments. They would all sit around and watch me type a simple password into an anti-customer screen. At first, they would be skeptical, but as they devised more and more sophisticated experiments, their fascination would grow. They would eventually have to acknowledge that I live my life inside my own little computer Bermuda Triangle. When it comes to online forms that require you fill out page after page of details, it's truly a lost cause for me. Why is it that if you leave a period off an email address or a comma out of a series, it doesn't just ask you to correct the offending line on the form? No, all the data you've entered is erased and you must start again from scratch. Do they hire people to develop these systems and then never check to see what they've created? You might think that you could reason with the online powers that be, except you'd have to hire a web-savvy detective just to find a phone number. Once you find a phone number, you're sent to voicemail prison, where all the problems or questions you have must fit into four categories. Let's say that your copier repair guy comes, and while he's there, you think he accidentally took your wallet because he drove off in your car. You call the number he gave you, and you find yourself listening to a suite of possible issues you could have, but none of them would have anything to do with renegade repair people. I would love to understand the thought process that not only established such systems, but allowed them to stay in place. I imagine a scene in a boardroom at a company that makes eye widgets. CEO Frump Bucket. People, our sales are down last quarter, and this is unacceptable. We hoped our new emphasis on customer service would make a difference, and yet our profits continue to slide. Need I remind you that if we don't get a competitive edge, we will not be in the business much longer. Any ideas? Gordon, who is new to the company and sitting in a back corner, nearly invisible to the first string executives around the table, raises his hand. CEO Front Bucket. Yes, you in the back. Gordon. What if we tried talking to our customers? Loud laughter. CEO Front Bucket. Okay, next on the agenda. How can we make our online frequently asked questions page longer? It seems clear that most companies don't want you to get even as far as voicemail prison, and that they would rather you spend the day going through their frequently asked questions section. If you had all day, you could scroll through a list of 1,150 questions to see if you could find an answer to the one you have. My blender is emitting a cloud of blue smoke even after it's unplugged that has so far killed my parakeet, my cats, and wilted all the flowers in my house. What do I do? It makes me wonder how effective we would all be if we required each interaction with our family to begin with a password that includes three numbers, a swear symbol like pound sign or ampersand, and some other word. And what if all our interactions had to fit in one of four categories? Me. Honey, I'm home. Why does it smell like smoke and gasoline in the garage? My wife. Welcome home. In order to better serve you, please select one of the following categories. If you want to complain about work, please press 1. If you want to volunteer to clean the toilet, please press 2. If you want to see today's junk mail, please press 3. If you want to pretend to listen to me, please press 4. You get the idea. I can remember the good old days when only the mafia used passwords and when kids got to ride in the back of an open pickup truck and when our main source of news was John Boy Walton. It makes me feel like moving far, far away and then coming back and trying to sell my services as a consultant. If I could get one major company to listen to me, I know I could make a huge difference in their bottom line. Then everyone would want to pay me to share with them the secrets of success in the online and voicemail world. People would think me a genius. Eventually, my phone would start to ring off the hook. I would have to hire people who are capable of processing off-script questions to answer my phones. I would not create a website with frequently asked questions to better serve my customers. I would not gather information from them in long online forms or require them to make up strange passwords if they wanted to reach me. I would hire Gordon. This is Steve Eaton.
As you tune to daily in-depth reports and balanced analysis during this election season, please pledge your allegiance to Utah Public Radio. Fall fundraising begins on Tuesday with a web pledge day. Your personal pledge of financial support will set the trend for this campaign. The daily goal is 100 pledges and $10,000. Our success depends on you. Don't wait until Tuesday. Pledge your support now at upr.org. Be a voice. Be involved. Become a UPR member or renew your membership. Go to upr.org. That's upr.org. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Utah Public Radio. This is KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan. This is Utah Public Radio, Utah's favorite public radio station.